Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me as always is my co-host, Erin. Erin, say hi.
Well, it's a bit touch and go, but yes, I am here.
You're not completely with us.
I've not, I am still here. I haven't, there was a moment where I thought something awful might happen.
It was touch and go, was it?
That's going to sound gross. I'm not going to say anything.
Just to cut out a lot of probably disgusting talk, Aaron's obviously feeling a bit sick, but he's mustered up the energy and has turned out to get this week's episode going. Yeah. So
my loyalty to the podcast and its listeners knows no limits.
We will drive ourselves through the hell and high water.
A red dawn.
All right. I mean, we don't exactly need a charge into
death.
Anyway, what have you been up to? It's April Fool's Day today. Whilst we're recording this, have you been, I'm assuming, gorging yourself on copious amounts of chocolate?
No, because I do have a little bit of chocolate, but I was just so ill, I can't even look at it right now. Today's the first time I've had a proper meal.
Oh.
Over the course of bank holiday weekend. I think we were in bed for like 2 days.
I would say, have you had any wildlife encounters or any natural history encounters, but probably not many from where you are.
No, although we were listening to the tawny owls. We had the window open to allow some fresh air in, and we were listening to the tawny owls. There was, I reckon, three of them, judging from the slight difference in distance and where they were, and the direction from which these calls were coming from. There's no way this bird was just flying in a triangle.
Yeah.
For that long, there's definitely three.
What you would assume is they're out there, you know, being territorial and everything.
Yes.
What it was the three birds were going, soon he will be dead. Yeah. Soon we will be able to scavenge.
Swoop in through the window and pick up what's left from his bones. What else have I been doing wildlife-wise? Not really a super great deal, I don't think. Like I say, I've been feeling rough for fair few days now. It's actually start of the week. So the day after we recorded last week's this last weekend's episode, we went up for a walk to spot some bats, and we did manage to spot a couple, but I couldn't tell you what species they were.
No, they usually sort of whiz past you too quick.
Yeah,
without a bat detector, it's quite hard.
It was pretty cool just doing it as a family and getting the little one involved in that. Dan Luisietti, one of our long-term listeners, asked a fair while ago what you can do to get family members involved. And a bat walk is a good one because it's a nice night. You're going out for a leisurely stroll and just looking up,
especially
around the trees and
the nights become warmer as well.
Yeah. So there you go. I mean, it's a suggestion that is probably over a year late, but there you go.
That's not too bad. Well, I was feeling slightly healthier than you by the sounds of it, Erin. Wildlife sort of wise, other than doing a bunch of stuff out in the garden and prepping a life-sized basking shark head and tail, for our upcoming live show, which is now taking up a good amount of room in my spare bedroom. This basking shark head just sort of sitting in there. I did manage to do a little bit of spotting at the in-laws today. We went round there for lunch, and there was a song thrush on their front lawn, which is quite nice. We actually released a song thrush there quite a while ago, or Drew and Jess did, actually. that they'd hand-reared as an injured bird. So it may not be the same bird, but we like to think that it is the same one that's still hanging around. Their garden gets quite a lot of wildlife, in fact, and it's always fun going there because they get hedgehogs, they get foxes. There was 3 foxes overnight just sat there on the lawn, just wandering around and having a good sniff. And then this afternoon, whilst we're all sat down having lunch, a stoat just sort of wandered onto their patio and then disappeared up their hedge line. I'm exceedingly jealous of the amount of wildlife they get in their garden. Yeah, it's always always good to see.
Every now and then, my mum tells me there's polecats near her garden, and my brother actually managed to record them potentially attacking a rabbit. It was dark, so you couldn't see it. Every now and then, you could see eyes shine, but you could hear that there was some sort of tiny mustelid, and there was a rabbit in a lot of stress.
Well, I mean, the original description that my father-in-law gave at the time was he saw something that looked polecat-sized that was climbing up a tree. And I was like, oh, is this a possibility? We've got pine martens in this area.
Because
we're sort of smack bang between Exmoor and Dartmoor. So we know that there's projects that are going to get them here. So you never know. But no, it turned out to be a stoat, as we saw it sort of on the cameras reappearing at the end of the garden. But that was really cool. So, should we launch into this week's news and start things off?
Let's take wing.
It's the news!
Right, well, we're into this week's news. Aaron, take us away.
Every week, the weird and wonderful world of natural history offers up an embarrassment of riches when it comes to news and interesting stories. And though we here at the Natural History Cupboard are but a small team, it's our aim to keep you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, up to date on the good, the odd, and the exciting. So let's open up the Natural History Cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive in. I think I've got the first article today, and it comes to us from fizz.org online, and it's spectacular news for me. Potentially, because Indonesia hunts clues as studies suggest Javan tiger may still exist. A single hair discovered outside of a West Java village in 2019 has led to excited speculation that the Javan tiger may in fact still roam this land. The big cat went extinct in the 80s, but a sighting outside of a plantation near Sukabumi City led scientists to comb the area for evidence, resulting in the find of this hair. I will just add that when they examined the hair, they found similarities between it and Sumatran tigers and Bengal tigers, but interestingly, no similarities between the other tigers, which that is a little bit suspect, but we'll see.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Well, my first one this week, and I love this because it's odd and it fits the category of odd natural history news. This is from ABC News Australia. Video of sperm whales dropping a bubble of poo off Western Australia to prevent orca attack in rarely recorded encounter.
That's how I deal with my enemies.
I mean, you know what? If it works, it works. So the video itself is only about 40 seconds long, and it shows a recorded attack of orcas against some sperm whales off the coast of Western Australia. It was a mother and calf, which, you know, is the usual MO for most orcas. Ooh, let's take the baby. They're just psychopaths of the sea, I think. They, you know, they're brilliant, but they are a little bit psychopathic. The sperm whales, though, have found a brilliant way of defending themselves called defensive defecation. The mother sperm whale let loose a bubble of diarrhea, which she then started to swish in the direction of the attacking orcas, to the point where the orcas essentially turned tail and went, "Nah, it's not worth it," and left
my
them
eyes!
Alone.
My eyes.
in what is described as a bubble of diarrhea in a defecation defense is just, yeah. I mean, confuse your enemies. Get out of it just by pooing in their face and running away, or getting them to run away. To be honest, that will get most things to turn and just not want to deal with you. Not that I've ever tried it.
That's one pod of orcas with some serious pink eye.
But yeah, if there's finally an animal that is standing up to orcas, it's by pooing in their face.
So my next article was actually going to be on orcas as well, but I've got a bit of a sad article for the last one. So I'm going to sandwich it. I'm going to give you a poo sandwich. I'm going to stick the bad news in the middle. This comes to us again from fizz.org, and it's unfortunately sea urchin killer spreads to new species. Yeah, didn't really want to do this one as I prefer to target good news this season. But to get to the first episode of April and only now do a bad news article is something of a small win for me, I feel. Plus, it's an update on a previous news article I covered last season. So you'll remember about the parasitic infection that wiped out long-spined sea urchins in the Caribbean and off the coast of Florida. And I said that they were moving into the Sea of Oman and potentially onwards into the Mediterranean as well. Well, yeah, it started in the Caribbean 2 years ago. And I mentioned about it last year. It's not looking good. So basically, it's as I said last year, it's moved into the Sea of Oman through shipping lanes, and now the news takes an even worse turn as the parasite has spread to a previously unaffected species of sea urchin, increasing the risk factor for population and species crashes as a result. So yeah, that really unfortunate news there.
Not great. Well, I'm going to continue the bad news.
How dare you
make this this fecal sandwich even worse? From the BBC, I have got rare white-tailed eagle found dead in Roscommon. So with what tends to be, well, far too many of these attacks, quite often, I would say, the white-tailed eagle has been found shot dead in Roscommon. Now, this is back in the 15th of March. I've actually been holding on to this one since before our Easter episode that we did. But the National Parks and Wildlife Service of Ireland is investigating the discovery of a dead white-tailed eagle near Cranberry Loch in County Roscommon. They confirmed that the bird had been shot, and they're awaiting forensic tests to basically find out, well, who's done it, and hopefully prosecute them heavily, because we don't need this sort of thing happening to our birds of prey, especially ones we fought so hard to bring back to the UK. The two-year-old female was released on the shores in 2022 as part of a reintroduction program, and satellite tags are attached to the chicks at birth to track their progress, hence why they basically know where these birds are at pretty much all times. The Irish Minister for the State of Nature, Heritage and Electoral Reform, it's one hell of a job title there, a few things mashed together, Malcolm Noonan said that he was devastated by the news of the death of one of our beloved white-tailed eagles. These majestic birds have been part of our reintroduction program to restore their native populations in Ireland, and to think that one had been shot is unconscionable, he said. So, yeah, that's not great, and hopefully people will be caught and prosecuted.
Yeah, I hope so. So we'll fly on back over to orcas at fizz.org again. New research reveals full diversity of killer whales as two species come into view on Pacific coast. So orcas have long been considered to belong to just one species, with many ecotypes spread globally. However, a new study has finally begun to piece together a more complex understanding of the orca family, with two species now being officially recognized. The research looked at two orca ecotypes in the North Pacific Ocean and has identified them as two separate species. So you have the resident orca, and then you have the formerly known as transient orca, which is now the Biggs orca. Some differences between the two include that the resident orca they're preying on salmon and other fish stock, which is why they're suffering quite badly at the moment, as you've heard us talk about previously. Whilst the bigs prey on larger mammal prey. Also, the resident orcas live as basically large and closely allied family pods, whereas the bigs orcas live in smaller groups. The two groups, furthermore, do not mix, which is also an early indicator of them being separate species.
Hmm. So that would be the bigs orca that ends up with a mouthful of poo water from those sperm whales.
Yes, I think it would be, yeah. And not to be confused with anyone flying X-Wings to blow up Death Stars.
Well, true. Out of interest, Aaron, did we talk about that in your creature feature on orcas? What, as to whether they were considered? No. As to whether at that point, had they been, is this such new news that it didn't feature other than you calling them transient and resident, I'm guessing?
No, at the time of my orca creature feature, they were considered transient orca pods that basically migrate through an area, and resident orca pods that live in an area.
Mm, well, there you go. Yeah. They're constantly changing. Hence why I haven't touched Spinosaurus. Because yeah, that'll be out of date before I've even written the script for it. So my final article this week comes from ABC News again. And that, they seem to have a theme with their news articles, but they're brilliant ones, these. Echidnas caught eating the eggs of Queensland's bum-breathing turtles, potentially endangering the reptile's future. I'll give Aaron a second to breathe as he laughs himself into a corner. Okay. So, in short, scientists have published the first recorded instance of echidnas eating freshwater turtle eggs. They've been digging them up and eating them, which, if you think about it, for an echidna, that's a nice, easy source of protein. Mm-hmm. The bum-breathing bit, that's something that a lot of turtles can do, actually, is gather oxygen through their cloaca. Aaron is still finding it hard to breathe himself. Use your bum, Aaron. Breathe through your bum. So the findings shatter the assumption that these monotremes only eat insects, with growing evidence for a much broader diet. And the findings raise interesting considerations for species managers on whether the measures are needed to deal with native predators, and raises that obvious other interesting question. If you've got two endangered species that are living in an area, how do you manage them and allow them to, well, either predate on each other or interact with each other? But yeah, Aaron, have you managed to come back to us?
No, but I'm just thinking. Next time I get told off for passing wind, I'm gonna say I'm just bum breathing.
Okay. Yep.
Anyway, that just about wraps it up for this week's installment of the Natural History Covered News.
Take a second.
If you guys at home have news articles or topics of interest that you think we should cover, send them in. You can use any of the usual ways of contacting us, or you can use your bum breathing. You might just see your chosen article covered here or in a Natural History Covered News discussion. And with that said, it's my turn this week to bring that main topic to you. Now, there has been a bit of breaking news.
Just like your voice then.
I'd be like defending yourself with poo clouds and poo bubbles and now bum breathing turtles.
I bring the news.
What a cracking start to this episode. So I actually have two. There's actually been a bit of breaking news. So I'm gonna give you the choice. You gave me a choice a couple of weeks ago, Gareth. I'm gonna give you a choice. Either topic A or topic B, and it's random. I haven't
I'm gonna go with A.
A. Okay. Well, that turns out Unfortunately for me, that turns out to be the breaking news thing because I haven't prepared for this at all. I just saw it literally before we were getting started. And it's actually really relevant to something we spoke about last week. So I will save my other article for the next time it's my turn to do this. And you'll like that. Well, you won't like that article, but you'll like it in those.
We'll like that article.
It's in respect to the fact that it's to do with Australian fauna, but it's not particularly good news. But neither is this breaking news either. So there we go. So this comes to us from USA Today. And the headline is giant green anaconda found dead in the Brazilian Amazon, possibly killed by gunshot. Now, the reason why I thought, not good. The reason why I thought to bring this to you guys this week, when I saw it, when we were firing up the recording equipment today, is because there's a lot of news going around that the giant southern green anaconda that I spoke about a couple of weeks ago that was just freshly discovered, the one pushing 26 foot and a contender for being the world's largest snake, there was a rumor going around that it was that one that got killed, which was horrendous. And when I read that, I was like, that is just too bad. That's awful. I mean, it's awful anyway, but like to have only just discovered an animal and to then find it shot dead is just even more harrowing. However, it's not that anaconda. So a giant, I'll do the best I can without having prepared for this. A giant anaconda has been found dead in the Brazilian Amazon, possibly killed by a gunshot wound, according to a Dutch researcher who studies snakes and recently helped discover a giant anaconda that was a contender for the largest snake in the world. So yeah, basically the connection that this snake has to the southern green anaconda, I think that's the new one, that's the giant one, is that the team that was researching anacondas in that area for the Pole to Pole documentary with Will Smith that's going to be being made by National Geographic and streamed on Disney, that team, they're the ones that discovered that new species of green anaconda, the giant species. They also spent time with this population of anacondas, and they also were the ones that found this one dead. And unfortunately, the guy that went and checked it out, Professor Brian Fry, he actually spent a lot of time with this particular snake that was shot, and he actually expresses how sad it was. He, just to quote him, he says, "This particular specimen wasn't one of the new species, but was a southern green anaconda." Right, so I got it a bit confused. So northern green anacondas are the new species. They're the giant ones. The southern green anacondas are the ones that we already know of as Eunectes marinus, the standard green anaconda. I say standard, they're still huge. But just to clarify, the snake is not the same one that was found, which I believe they called Anna Julia. I think they called that one Anna Julia. Not that that makes any difference. Another person who was on the team, Professor Freak Vonk, he was the first person to find this southern green anaconda since it was killed. And he is quoted as saying in an Instagram post, "With enormous pain in my heart, I want to let you know that the mighty big green anaconda I swam with was found dead in the river this weekend." It's really sad. He continues, "I've heard from several sides that the giant one that they found was not the one that was shot to death, despite the fact that they a lot of media outlets are running with that." And weirdly, even though the article is saying that it's possibly shot to death, the authorities are actually refuting this and saying that they haven't found any evidence yet that the anaconda was shot. So I don't really know what's going on there. Either way, Brian Fry, the other scientist that I named, he says it's a senseless tragedy on the level of someone shooting a panda. And whilst a few people might balk at that and think that that's, it's not the same, you're thinking that because a panda is fluffy. Green anacondas are incredibly vulnerable and they are on the precipice. And if someone has shot this green anaconda, it is near the same as shooting a panda. If not worse, because they don't have that public appeal that the panda does. It's an attack on all of conservation is what it is, really. It's just really sad. One of these guys was saying that he had spent an hour diving with this snake, and she just tolerated him being on the on the riverbed, like in very close proximity to her as he dove around there. So I'm hoping that in this series they will actually have footage of this snake as they spent so much time with her. But it is an enormous shame, and really is a crime against the planet that this green anaconda has been shot.
Yeah, that's really sad. And like you say, the bigger implication is that a lot of people probably won't care, because as you said, reptiles are seen, especially snakes, are not seen as anywhere near as charismatic as something like a panda or something else. But they play just as important ecological role as any other creature around, and can often suffer far worse fates at the hands of people through fear and prejudice than any large charismatic mammal. Even probably the most hated large charismatic mammal would still have far more people defending it than say a reptile would. I think,
Especially a snake.
Yeah.
I bet you, if you were to pick, let's think of the largest lizard in the world, Komodo dragon, because that's kind of the lizard equivalent of largest snake, against green anaconda, you'll find more fans of a Komodo dragon than you will of an anaconda, definitely. I reckon.
Yeah, definitely. Which is kind of sad.
Yeah. I do just want to, I found one of the quotes that I was actually looking for from that Professor Freak Vonk. He said, it just shows you how much these people care for what they're doing and the animals that they encounter. He says, it's these kinds of extremely large and old species that are extra vulnerable. If there is more news, I will, of course, share immediately. The fact that I got to spend over an hour with her at the bottom of the river remains one of my most breathtaking experiences in nature, and one I will never forget. I love you so much. That's they spend this time with these animals with the intent of educating all of us about them, and hopefully through that education, preserving and conserving them. To have one then, well, it's much the same as when we, or similar, I would say, as when we're looking after endangered animals and in a zoo, and we lose one of them. It's having that, it's the level of your connectedness to that individual and to that species as a conservation target, and then having that torn away. And it's not just the emotion, it's also the importance to the planet that animal represents.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, sad that that's happened. And hopefully, well, as with the eagle thing, hopefully justice will catch up with them.
Yeah.
If not legislative justice, then karmic justice. Maybe they'll trip over and get bitten by a venomous snake or something, whoever's done that.
Trip over face first into a bum-breathing turtle.
Whilst a whale defends itself with defecation all over them.
Yes. There we go. We brought it back with laughter.
There you go. Right, well, let's head into our creature feature for this week, shall we? And we'll see where we go from there. Less defecation, I feel, though.
It's the creature feature.
This week's creature feature, I was originally intending on talking about giant prehistoric fungus that dominated the planet long before trees had even evolved, called Prototaxis. However, life gets in the way, as it so often does. And this is where this week's creature feature has taken a bit of a turn. So for those of you who are long-term listeners, or for those of you who know me, you would know that I've had a parrot for many, many years. His name is Charlie, and he was an Indian ringneck. And you probably guessed from the terms, past tense, that I'm using. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Earlier last month, unfortunately, he passed away from a heart attack. And obviously, I was, rather broken by the whole thing. It's never nice losing a pet, especially a pet that's been with you for some 23 years. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to pay tribute to him at some point on the podcast. And what better point than today? He will be missed, and he was a massive part of my life. And well, anyone who's ever lost a pet before will know, obviously, that it does leave quite a large hole to be filled. So we won't be doing giant prehistoric fungus this week, but we will come back to them. It's still on my list. Just sort of rearrange things around because I feel that it's somewhat more appropriate to look at this particular species of parrot than to look at giant fungus this week.
Yeah.
So this week's creature feature is on the Indian ringneck parrot, or the Indian ringneck parakeet, or the rose ringneck parrot, or there is a variety of different names for these guys in their native and non-native range, which we'll get into in a minute. And for those of you who can see the artwork that Drew has done for this episode, you'll notice that it is in fact not the normal color for a Indian ringneck. Normally, these parrots are green in color. However, my Charlie, was a leucistic parrot, which means that he has less melanin in his skin than a normal parrot would, which meant he was a lovely yellow in color. Let me just preface this as well with saying a lot of the information I'll be giving about this species is to do with how they are found in their wild environment, but also a vast majority of it is actually to do with the fascinating feral populations of these birds in the UK, as well as, well, a massive range, as you will see as we go on. So they're found in their wild range, but they're almost more interesting because they're not, in my mind, at least anyway. So what is an Indian ringneck? For those of you who know what these birds look like, you'll be pretty much spot on with your assumptions, obviously. But if not, these are a smallish parrot. They're about 40 centimeters in length, including the tail feathers. In fact, a large proportion of these birds is tail feather. They have lovely long tail feathers. And the wing length of most of them is between 15 to 17 and a half centimeters in length. So to give you a rough size idea of one of them, they're bigger than a budgie. They're bigger than a cockatiel, but they're smaller than something like a Amazon parrot. Their next sort of closest size would be something like, imagine a conure, if you know what a conure looks like, but with a longer tail feather. Is probably the best way of describing them. So the adults are sexually dimorphic, and that means that obviously the males and the females look different. The adult male sports a pink and black ringneck, hence where the name comes from. The black bit actually differs in some of the subspecies as to how much black there is under the red color of the ring. But in female birds, they obviously don't have a ring, as well as immature birds. So starting off their life, you can never tell whether a Indian ringneck is necessarily a male or a female, unless you have it surgically or DNA sexed, which there's no real need to. Just wait until it grows a little and it'll become evident whether it's a boy or a girl. Some of the females can occasionally display like very pale shadow-like feathers that look very similar to their might being the start of a ring there, but it won't go any further than that. Now, both sexes have a distinct green color in the wild, with a lovely bright red beak, which is part of their, I think, their really nice coloring as well. Then again, I don't think there's ever such a thing as a dull looking parrot.
No.
So, part of what makes a ringneck is their taxonomy. So there are four subspecies that are recognized, and they differ a little bit from each other. Like I was saying, they do have slightly different amounts of either black underneath that ring or not. So there are African subspecies and Asian subspecies, interestingly, almost sharing a parallel, I think, with lions. And if you cast your mind back to when we talked about the African lion with James Welch,
yeah, from Safina.
Yes, you'll notice that he talked about how there was basically two populations of lions, the Eastern or Sub-Saharan and Saharan, or no, was it Sub-Saharan and North Saharan or something like that?
Yes,
I think it was East and West or something like that.
Yeah, East and West.
So...
You could change with lions so many times, it is confusing.
You could basically put ringnecks in the same group. So the African subspecies, which is Psittacula karamii, which is found throughout West Africa, Guinea, Senegal, southern Mauritania, east to western Uganda, southern Sudan, north up into Egypt, and along the Nile, and actually into Giza itself. And it's occasionally seen on the north coast of the Sinai. It's basically sort of stuck in that northern or stretch of Africa. Then you've got the Abyssinian subspecies of the ringneck, which is Psittacula karamii parvovistris, which is only found in northwestern Somalia, west across to northern Ethiopia and into Sudan as well. Now, the Asian subspecies, which is the Indian rose ring parrot or the Indian ringneck parrot, if you want to go with that, which is Psittacula karamii malanensis, and that was what Charlie was. He was a Indian ringneck in that sort of sense. So the African ones have a slight bit of a darker patch underneath their ring, whereas the Indian ones, it's slightly less. So the Indian ones are found in southern India, and these are the ones that make up the vast majority of the feral populations throughout the rest of the world. And there is one final one in the Asian subspecies, which is the boreal rose-ringed parrot, which is Psittacula karamii borealis. And that is found in Bangladesh, Pakistan, northern India, and Nepal, up into central Burma. And they're found in a few released populations in different parts of the world. The Asian subspecies are both larger than the African subspecies. So, as you can imagine, the African ones are just a little bit smaller, just got that slightly different color on their throat. For the scientific name, so Psittacula is a diminutive of the Latin Psittacus or Psittacine, which is parrot, and the specific name karamii commemorates the Austrian naturalist Wilhelm Heinrich Kramer. So yeah, that's where their scientific name comes from. So whether you call it a rose-ringed parakeet or a Indian ringneck, it just depends on how you want to talk about these birds. They've been popular as pets for a very long time in aviculture. And in fact, the ancient Greeks kept the Indian subspecies and the ancient Romans kept the African subspecies. There you go. That says something about the tastes of the ancient Greeks and the Romans when it came to their pet shops, I guess.
Yeah, that's an interesting anecdote.
So distribution for these birds. This is going to take up, well, shall we say, the majority of what we're going to be talking about, because they are a fascinating bird. There's a good chance that a number of you have seen these birds or heard them or even have them living near you and maybe even in your garden. They are native to two main regions in the world. As I've pointed out, you've got them in Asia and in Africa, spread across Pakistan, India, and Nepal for the Asian subspecies, with the majority of where they are found, and then across Africa for the African subspecies in Guinea, Senegal, Mauritania, and right up as far as Sudan and Ethiopia and Egypt. But these aren't the only places you might see these birds. In fact, they've become more established in a list of countries that is incredibly inclusive. I've actually just put Europe, because the list for Europe is almost every country in Europe, certainly including the UK. They are found. They're found in the US, in South Africa, the Middle East, Australia, Japan. In the US, they're found in Florida, California, and Hawaii. So even as far out into the Pacific Islands. Yeah. There are populations also found in Turkey, in Istanbul. You'll find them in Tehran as well. Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, Iran, the UAE, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman. Basically, they are found pretty much globally now.
Yeah.
As well as New Zealand is one of the most recent populations that seems to have appeared. So here in the UK, records of these parrots living in the wild can go back as far, have gone back as far as the mid-19th century. But it's only since the late 1990s that these parrots have been seen the most in London and southeastern England in significant numbers, and starting to settle as well elsewhere in the rest of the country. So why are there parrots in London, especially? Because London is a stronghold for these birds here in the UK. I don't know, Aaron, have you seen one when you've gone to London?
I've seen them. I've seen them in three different places, but if you're specifically talking UK, then yes, I have seen them and heard them in London.
Yeah, you tend to hear them more than you see them a lot of the time, especially if you're out and about and not sat specifically looking for them. I can honestly say every time I've gone to London, I've at least heard one. And the first time that I heard and saw one whilst walking around London Zoo, actually, interestingly enough, Aaron, it was the day that myself and Drew went there and you woke up midday whilst we'd taken 4 hours to get, you know, up there, and we were halfway around the zoo by this point. Then you realized that was the day we were going there. Myself and Drew were sitting there watching these parrots whilst in the middle of London Zoo.
I feel like you and Drew are never going to let me live this down.
Oh, no, never. Because it's the fact that you were so surprised that when you woke up in the middle of the day. We didn't drop it on you. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The birds there, when seeing them for the first time, was an absolute pleasure, because there's something about seeing the animal that you spend a lot of time with in the wild. And I would say that you've probably had the same feeling when you've, say, seen some of the animals that you've either worked with or kept as pets in their in a wild setting. I say in their wild habitat,
definitely.
This is definitely not their native habitat. But it's a different feeling. It's weird. There are records of these birds in a variety of different places. And as such, there's a variety of theories as to where these birds have come from. Some of the most popular ones include escaped birds from the set of a 1951 film, The African Queen, which was filmed in the west of London. Supposedly, the rumor goes that somebody opened the studio door and the flock of birds that had been flying around the studio for part of this filming just flew out, because they're birds. That's what they do. Another rumor is that Jimi Hendrix released a pair on Carnaby Street as a symbol of his love for his girlfriend at the time. And they released a pair of them right in the middle of the capital, Carnaby Street as well. But according to a study which mapped the historical news reports and sightings of these birds, none of these urban myths really ring true. It's mostly because they don't fit the time periods where these birds have started showing up in a lot of these places. They're nice little stories, and I like the connections, but yeah, they don't fit historically. So researchers from Queen Mary University of London wrote that most ornithologists believe that these parrots have spread in the UK more likely as consequences of repeated releases and introductions. So people either having them as pets and then just letting them go, or having them and them escaping, which is probably far more likely. And it tends to be how a lot of these things go. We look at the long list of animals that are living wild in the UK today, wallabies being one of them, raccoon dogs and things like that getting loose every now and again, muntjac deer, exactly.
I believe at one point we actually had two, uh, a, a, populations of skunks and porcupines in two separate areas of the UK.
Yeah, I think, yes, I remember something about the porcupines. I think they were in Wales.
The ones I heard about were down near Dartmoor. The skunks, I think, were Forrester Dean and New Forest.
Interesting. Ringnecks have been recorded in most English counties. They've also been recorded right here in Devon as well. Mostly South Devon by the sounds of it. Much of Wales, parts of Scotland around the borders, though. And even across the Irish Sea into Northern Ireland. And the BTO, the British Trust for Ornithology, estimated that there is roughly 12,000 breeding pairs in 2016. So that's obviously increased by this point, with numbers growing every single year. While these birds may have a gradual spread out from London and the surrounding counties, the populations further north, especially Manchester and Birmingham, are thought to be the results of separate introductions. They do particularly well near human cities and have basically made their homes in many urban and city parks, especially London's Richmond Park to Didsbury in South Manchester and Glasgow's Victoria Park, where they have basically set up camp. Now, obviously, I have a love for this species. That's fairly evident. I also have a love for native species as well. And this leaves me severely conflicted because, as I just said, I really enjoy seeing these guys in the wild. I say in the wild, wild in the UK. There's that connection to, obviously, a pet. However, it would appear that I'm not the only one who has this conflicted opinion of these birds. If you look into many of the reports of people's interactions with feral Indian ringnecks, in their gardens, especially in the UK, you will find that there is very much a dual love and hate relationship. Some people seem to really like the idea of having very exotic animals turn up at their bird feeder. And let's face it, that's really kind of cool. If you had an Indian ringneck turn up on your bird feeder, Aaron, would you, I don't know, what would be your first thought? My first personal thought would be, where's that come from? That's
probably someone's pet. Where's that come from? There would be a moment of enjoyment. And then I'd be wondering what the impact of you being here is.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't think they do too well around our way. Well, probably not as well out by you, because you're right up onto Exmoor. At least I'm sort of in the middle of a town.
Yeah.
They would probably have more available food nesting sites and places to live.
In terms of exotic animals as well, like turning up on your bird feeder, like that's a pretty enjoyable one to go with. Like the narrative changes somewhat when a grizzly bear turns up on your bird feeder in the middle of Devon.
That poses a much larger question, I think. and that seems to be the reaction that a lot of people have, is that they really love seeing these birds and really like feeding them as well. The advice that the BTO gives is, if you do not want these birds obviously getting into your bird feeders, because they're somewhat like squirrels in the fact that they're smart and they can manipulate things, not just with their beak, but with their feet, so they can get into most bird feeders, is to use squirrel-proof ones. That usually keeps these guys out. A lot of people also find their call rather shrill and loud.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm used to that call, and it can be loud. Charlie could be very loud when he wanted to, and he would certainly let you know when he wanted something. He had a routine, and he would let you know when he wanted to go to bed. He would let you know when his food had was past the point where he wanted more food. He'd let you know when he wanted to come out as well. So he was setting a routine, and he would tell you these things. They can make a variety of different calls. So this is an Indian ringneck call. Thank you. So yeah, they're quite a noticeable call. Like say, you would hear that before you'd probably see the bird.
There are people who are listening now, not just in London, but all across the world, I suppose, thinking, I've been wondering what that noise was.
Yeah, no, there's probably a lot of people who are not sure about it as well.
But you would have heard it and not known what it is for so long.
Yeah. So a ringneck's call, this main call that they make, is basically their main communication to other members of their flock. They'll fly around in large groups, and obviously it's a very good way of letting each other know where you are. Parrots are generally quite loud animals anyway, so no amazing news there. They also make a huge variety of different other calls as well, from little squeaks and chirps right the way through to whistles. They're particularly good at imitating whistles, and some people can even have even got pet ones that will obviously imitate speech. Charlie was more for whistling than he was for speech. He used to be able to whistle part of Scotland the Brave. So just a fun little thing, as you do. Like I say, we have to acknowledge the conservation angle as well and the destructive nature that parrots can have, especially with them not being native. There is very much an argument that these birds have been capable of kicking smaller birds out of nest hollows, especially things like woodpeckers, which would obviously make the nest or make the hollow. And then these birds will, steal it from them. So I can see that there is definitely a conservation angle that needs to be addressed with these birds. Like I say, I'm just very, very conflicted in what to deal with and what to do with these birds. Maybe bring them all to me. I don't know. I'll quite happily have a huge flock of them or something. Diet-wise, in the wild, ringnecks usually feed on, fruit, flower buds, vegetables, nuts, berries, seeds. And wild flocks also fly several miles in order just to forage on farmland in India and Pakistan and other parts of their range. They're known to also turn up in orchards in parts of India, which makes them very unpopular, by basically pillaging everyone's fruit. They've also fed on cereal grains during the winter, as well on pigeon peas, which is a particularly common crop in another part of India as well. In Egypt, during the spring, they're known to feed on mulberry bushes, and in summer, they often feed on date palms and nest inside the palms themselves and eat sunflowers and corn straight from the fields. Basically, they find food anywhere they can. One big thing that makes these birds so successful is that they are opportunistic feeders. They will basically learn quite quickly to exploit a variety of food sources. Whether it's seeds or fruits, flowers, young buds on trees. They'll even eat tree bark to get by, to make sure that they've still got something. They're just very, very adaptable animals. And our fondness as well as, I would say our fondness in the UK, but I think it extends to most of the world, for feeding species in our gardens also helps them out massively, because in the UK they'll turn up on bird tables as well, feeding them as these exotic visitors to our gardens. It doesn't end there, though, with our fondness for having exotic species in our garden of the plant variety from all around the world that seasonally bloom in different parts of the year. We've basically provided food sources, not just from where they come from in the wild, but also a seasonal food source from all around the world that these will make use of and get into. Now, there is also the argument as well that they have been known to muscle their way to the front on bird tables because they are bigger and they can be aggressive as well if they want to. Having been bitten more than a few times by Charlie when he was in a bad mood, I can tell you that their bite does hurt. For a small bird, they're obviously going to back off. But you could say the same for a lot of other birds that turn up at bird feeders, will push others out of the way. And they don't have a free ride, because our native birds of prey and birds of prey right across the world have taken advantage of these very easy to spot, very loud birds, and will catch them and eat them. Sparrowhawks, peregrines, and buzzards will quite happily take them right here in the UK. and have been known to take them off bird feeders as well. So it's not all smooth sailing for the ringneck parrot.
Did you know, and like, forgive me if you're about to say this, but did you know in some places, at the very least, I know in Barcelona, mm-hmm. falconers actually train their peregrines to keep the population of Indian ringnecks down.
I wasn't aware that they'd been trained specifically to do that, but I was aware that there are calls to obviously do that in some of these larger urban areas as well.
Yeah, the falconers over there use their peregrines to essentially they replace their peregrines' pigeon prey item with
parrot
ringneck. Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, they are a species that is on the increase. And they are spreading further north in the UK. They are moving partly to do with our urbanization of areas. And because they like hanging out around gardens and easy places to find food, we will probably see the same situation all over the world with where these guys are found. They're not the only parrots that are following this trend. The monk parrot or Quaker parrot from Central America has done the exact same thing, because it is also a very popular pet and has also followed this exact same trend of becoming loose in parts of the world where it's not meant to. But that doesn't make these birds any less interesting than they are. And I know over the years that we've done this podcast, Aaron, I've said that there are many species I find absolutely fascinating and that I love. But this has to be the one for me that, well, has literally sat on my shoulder over the years for a very long time. Will always be a part of me in what I do and, you know, the way I look at these birds. And I still find it a little bit of a, like a mental image just pops up whenever these birds appear in the background of a documentary, usually if it's something about tigers or something to do with India, because, well, they're obviously native there and you hear them a lot in the background. It's just nice to hear that little earworm, I suppose, of their call. So that call will always will live rent-free in my brain for a very good reason, obviously. So whether you find this species to be a pest or the lovable rogue that I find it to be, or whether you live where it's native in India or Pakistan or parts of Africa, or whether you live where these birds are turning up in pretty much the rest of the world, they are a truly fascinating species to behold. And in a weird way, I never turn down the opportunity to hear one of these guys or see them in whatever country that they are in. And I know that whenever I hear that call, it's going to obviously make me think of Charlie. So he will be missed. And yeah, this one is for Charlie. So there is the Indian ringneck. Not much more to say, really.
A lovely bird, a lovely tribute to him. Can I put in an official request?
Ooh, I think you can.
I move for a vote to get the Charlie, your yellow Indian ringneck, added to the official door logo for the cupboard.
Oh, as in redo. Okay, I could see that. Yeah,
have him sat on top of, or stood on top of the door there.
I think we could certainly look into doing that. He will be nice. Part. He will certainly be part of the artwork for this year, and I very well may have to go and get myself a T-shirt.
I think you should.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's never nice losing a pet, especially one that's been with you for a long time. Saying that, though, I felt just as bad and as heartbroken when we had some of the rats die, and they only live for 2 years. So I think it's an animal's personality a lot of the time that gives you that connection.
Yeah,
and whether they live 100 years or 2 years, you know, it can still live with you for a long time.
Yeah.
So, shall we move on to our emails for this week?
Yeah, let's flock that way.
Oh, God.
Bing! You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email. Right, well, we're into this week's emails. We're going to start things off with our question from last week, which was our Easter-based question or spring-based question. But specifically, if you could replace the Easter rabbit, because I still refuse to say bunny, what would you replace it with and why? I still think, and hands down, this is because, not just because she's my wife, but also because she gave such a detailed and descriptive version of things, I still think Paris's version is the best one, which we will go back over because she actually put it on here as well.
She converted me on that one as well, actually.
In a really disgusting way. It's so accurate. Anyway, first on the list, Robin Clark, definitely a monotreme of some sort so that they can just still smuggle the eggs. Steve Eddy has put the Easter Wolverine, no egg nicking. You know what? I kind of like that, actually. No one's going to mess with an Easter Wolverine. Philip Schofield has replied saying the Easter Penguin would do that. Penguins being the devil's spawn and all. I take it the two of them have a vendetta against penguins. He's then put his own comment from Philip Schofield. The hair, which it was originally and should be.
Yeah.
Spencer Seams has put the Easter turkey vulture. It would eat the scraps from your Easter meal, and you don't eat vultures. Oh, I see. Sorry. The Easter turkey vulture. It would eat the scraps from your Easter meal that you didn't eat, and vultures need a rebrand anyway, and this could work for them. I like it. Anything that puts vultures in a good light.
Absolutely.
Danny Kevin has put, as the groundhog is already taken by Bill Murray, it would have to be the dwarf lemur. Due to its hibernation, I would say. Unfortunately, it doesn't lay eggs, though. Very true. I mean, most of the animals on this list kind of don't.
Rabbits don't either, though.
No, I know.
Nor bilbies.
I don't think that's a prerequisite whatsoever. So we now get to Paris's fantastic remark, which was the tapeworm. It absorbs your extra calories, so you can eat as much chocolate as you like and not gain weight. Lays a lot of eggs, which searching for can be fun. good representative symbol of life and rebirth in its cycle. Easily shared with your loved ones for the family inclusivity aspect as well. I mean, it ticks all the boxes, you know, stick some little ears on it. Boom, there you go. Aaron Eschenbrenner Cocker has put the platypus. It's an all-in-one. And Stuart Beard has put definitely a dog. I like dogs. You know what? That's kind of cool. You know, the Easter dog just goes and finds the eggs for you and brings them to you. Although don't allow dogs to eat chocolate. Not good for them.
No.
So that was our fantastic suggestions from last week. And to tie in this week with both the sighting that I had today of that lovely stoat, as well as Indian ringnecks turning up in people's gardens all around the world in places that they're not native to, our question for this week is, what is the oddest or rarest creature you've ever had turn up in your garden or outside of your window if you don't have a garden? And you can let us know that on you can let us know that on our Facebook page, where that will be up, where you can put your answer. So, Aaron, what is the oddest creature you've had turn up, or rarest creature, in your garden?
Oh, I really am not too sure. You know what? I would go with the oddest because, no, it doesn't even fit the definition of odd. Okay, I'm going to have to bend the rules of this question somewhat. The most special...
That still fits, yeah.
Okay, the most special sightings and I suppose the rarest sightings for me personally, where I used to live on the bird feeder, I used to get a great spotted woodpecker.
Nice.
That was the other side of that was the far side of South Moulton. That was now where I live. I haven't seen it since, but when I was digging the hole to do the patio, On the fresh, I mentioned this actually in the previous podcast. On the fresh mound of earth that I'd made, obviously lots of worms coming up from that, and there was a green woodpecker on that. So both times have been woodpeckers. I can't think of anything being rarer or odder than that that I've seen in my gardens.
That's pretty cool. All right, as you've gone for two houses that you've lived in, I'm going to play the Australia card on this one.
G'day.
So the first one being where we lived in Australia, the most special, or you know, the nicest creature to have turned up, or rarest visitor to the garden, was some red rump parrots, which are a type of grass parrot. Very, very pretty. And they only came down once or twice if we hadn't mown the lawn. And they came down to eat the seed heads on the grass. So a lot of the time we actually just left a patch of the lawn unmown so that they could come down and eat the seeds. Really, really pretty parrots. The other one being in the UK, because we back onto a forest here, I'm going to say it wasn't technically in the garden, but it was within 3 or so meters of our garden.
It was your doorstep, really.
Pretty much. I mean, we saw it from our window.
Yeah.
Just outside of the boundaries of our garden. It was within the first year of us moving in here. There was a deer right by the fence, and then it raised its head, and then next to it, a little fawn raised its head as well.
No, that's cool.
Lovely roe deer. And yeah, they hung around there for a little bit and then disappeared off into the wood. Unfortunately, we've never seen any deer come that close since, and we probably suspect it's because obviously the area is now a bit more populated with people that they don't come around as much anymore. But I reckon they're still there in the woods, just not as easy to spot. I think this was very much just a one-time deal.
Without giving too much information on where you live away, you know the really, really busy road, or the busier road in your area?
Yeah, yeah.
The other side of that from where you are, that's the place where I first ever saw a roe deer.
Oh, they're definitely there.
I'd seen red deer before. This is way before those houses were built. This is years and years and years ago when I was a kid. It's the first place I ever saw. I was in the back of my mum's car, and that's the first place I saw a roe deer.
Mm. No, they're definitely around there, because you do see signs of them, but yeah, they're just a lot harder to spot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let us know what the most special or rarest visit to your garden has been. And you can do that by commenting on our Facebook page. You can also get in contact. You can also get in contact with us in a variety of other ways. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all of those usual social media places, and our fantastic T-Mill store. But you can also email us and do that by sending your emails to thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com. And Aaron, I believe we have an email this week.
We do. This one you're going to really like, Gareth.
So, is it someone saying, here, Gareth, here's a large sum of money and your own private island?
All right, you might not like it as much as that.
Okay.
That just temper your expectations a bit.
Wow.
Last week we announced that we had a new Patreon member at the Animal Ambassador tier.
Mm.
Yeah? Well, this one is from him. So this comes from...
Hopefully good things. It's good things, right? It's not him asking for like his money back or something.
No. It's actually a really, really, really cool email. When I read this, I was chuffed. I immediately thought you're going to love this. And he's been very efficient in getting us the information we need. That comes at the end of the email, but I'll get right to it. So the title of his email is, I'm an Animal Ambassador. So first and foremost, thank you very much again, Nick, for joining us. And yes, this does indeed come to us from our new Patreon supporter, Nick Tenick. And he says, hey guys, I'm a big fan. I'm slowly getting through your library as I wait for new episodes to be released. Gareth is currently a professor in the outros. You guys are great. Oh, yes, I remember. I know where he is. Yeah. Just, you guys are great.
He knows exactly which episode.
No, it's the, you know, the nerdy little things that we say at the end where we try and rope in our love for geekdom into the natural world somehow.
Surprisingly, it takes us so many more redos and retakes than should actually be possible.
There's probably more thought goes into that than the actual product. Shouldn't say that. I'm sure that he's in that batch where we were saying, you know, I'm something of a professor myself.
Yeah.
You know, Gareth is something. Anyway, I'll read it from the top again. He says, "Hey guys, I'm a big fan. I'm slowly getting through your library as I wait for new episodes to be released. Gareth is currently a professor in the outros. You guys are great. In the past year, I've pivoted in life to work with and study this beautiful Tasmanian environment I live in. I quit my full-time job to study ecology. I've also become a snake catcher and wildlife rescuer, trying to do my bit. For my creature feature choice, I would like you guys to look into the spotted tiger quoll or Dasyurus masculatus. I love this animal. It's another that was heavily persecuted by pesky Europeans. If I may throw in a plant choice, the Huon pine, I hope I've pronounced it right. Huon pine would be interesting. Keep up the good work." Do you know what? For such a nice email, I'm kind of tempted to let him have both.
Yeah, no, definitely.
We'll do both.
Yep. We'll have to fit them in. But yes, yeah, they will be coming at some point in the coming cycle.
What a cool email. We're so happy to have you in the cupboard with us, Nick. And also, what a really cool turn in your life to just quit a full-time job to study something new and really turn your life around to aid in the local environment where you are.
I've often thought if I was still living in Australia, I think I would be a snake catcher. And use that as a way of being able to help educate people, because a lot of people who do snake catching are obviously passionate about reptiles and snakes themselves, but they're also passionate about teaching people about these animals. And whenever I know that you and I, Aaron, whenever we've been called out to help with different rescues and things as being zookeepers with various different bits of wildlife and that, you often end up educating people a little bit because they're interested about what's going on, why this animal's there, or you know what it is a lot of the time. So that's really cool. You're living the dream, I'd say. That sounds pretty pretty good, especially down in Tasmania as well. You've got some amazing wild spaces down there, and it's been a dream of mine to go to Tasmania at some point.
Nick, you can be the cupboard's official eyes on the ground for spotting Tasmanian tigers.
Well, do you know what, Aaron? This is something. This is completely off track here, and this is it's going to make the edit a painful thing because obviously you've got
a Lego phylocene you're going to pull out now.
I wish no. What I've always wanted to do, and this has come. There's two things I've always wanted to do. One of them I revealed in the Wallamai Pine episode, which was years ago in high school. I wanted to try and lead an expedition to try and find the valley where the Wallamai Pines are in a very sort of teenage-minded, not really thinking it through, would have probably ended up being lost in the wilderness sort of thought. But after watching a ridiculous cryptozoology thing the other night where some people were traipsing around looking for Mothman, in West Virginia and that, if we ever get to the point, Aaron, where we've got enough money in this podcast, we're going to Tasmania and we're looking for the thylacine, just hands down. We'll make our own trip there, and you know what, guaranteed, it doesn't matter if we see it or not, because knowing how badly it goes, whenever we try and film anything, it'll be standing right there in front of us. The only thylacine that's ever been seen, and the cameras won't work or something like that won't work.
We won't know it's there, but when we release the episode, people will be saying, there was one stood behind you. We'll have to go back and have a look.
yeah,
the footage.
So yeah, he will keep him as the eyes on the ground for the moment to spot any thylacines that might turn up. So yes, the Quoll and the Huang Pine will definitely be coming down the line there, I think.
Two very good suggestions, and thank you for being so so prompt and efficient in getting them to us. And thanks for your email. Yeah, and of course your Patreon support.
And remember, you can get in contact with us via email. Like I say, our email is thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com. And, well, that links neatly into where we talk about our lovely Patreons. So, Aaron, who are they?
Well, we want to... blah, 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 blah.
You're going to do them as Dracula, are you?
I was just saying, it sounds like Dracula.
Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, this week we want to thank Chelsea McKee, Connie P, Jen Greenhall, Fogtober, and, of course, Nick Tenick, who wrote in that lovely email to us that we just read out to you. Thanks, guys, for your continued Patreon support. You are helping to make this podcast better and helping to flesh out some plans and some aims that we have for this podcast and what we want to do for it and for you guys that listen. So, yeah, thank you again.
And just remember, if you want to join our Patreon, you can do so by going to our Patreon account and looking at all the different options there. You can also support us in many other ways, as money is not always an option. The first and most important thing you can do is, well, just listen to the episode. Always makes a difference, and you'll hopefully learn something along the way. You can obviously like, share, and subscribe with on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. And you can tell a friend, tell an enemy, tell a loud bunch of parrots in a park near you, because you never know, they might repeat it and they might start spreading the word that way.
That's a really good idea.
Quickly to London, Aaron. We have to find a bunch of parrots and get them to repeat that.
Get the parrots to become a bunch of Natural History Cupboard evangelists.
Exactly, yeah. You can also interact with us on our social media accounts where that's going up. And, of course, as well, you can come along to our upcoming live show, which is happening on April the 13th. Unnervingly, only 12 days away now, Aaron. Not at all scary, the amount of time that has gone very quickly. And, in fact, by the time this episode comes out, it'll be even less time.
Yeah,
that's
only
how
a week.
Time
and
works.
Then... Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very scary.
Tickets are available, I believe, through the Barnstable Library. For that, they've been sharing some of our posts out. In fact, our April Fool's post, which went up, I was spent a bit of time editing that. That was quite fun. hopefully, no one thinks that they're actually Scottish monkeys. Since that one was recaptured from the Highland Wildlife Park, there are no wild primates in Scotland other than humans. But yes, that pretty much brings us to, well, the end of this week's episode. So a big thank you, Aaron, for coming along.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Gareth, for having me on again. Thank you, listeners, for continuous journey. I do want to issue an apology, though. Because,
what?
Yeah, what well, last week I said both on...
Oh, God, you didn't say anything insulting when you spoke in Thai at the end, did you?
No, I didn't, but I did say both on the show and after the show had gone off that I was going to email a few people, including the library and Jim, who was nice enough to write in to us last week. And I have done neither because I've been feeling foul, and that's not a very good excuse. So I thought I'd issue
well, that's,
an apology
that's fair enough.
On air and get to it right away when this recording is finished.
Very good. And a big thank you. To you at home for listening, and we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.